Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 4th, 2022 issue of the Week magazine. Cover drawing this week is a circus scene. There's crowds in the background and lights, and it looks like it's the old three-ring circus. There's a startled-looking elephant in the middle of the ring, and several of the U.S. House of Representative members around. Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz are riding on top of the elephant. Leading the elephant is Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, and on the other side of the elephant standing with a fist raised is Representative Jim Jordan. The headline is the GOP's agenda. What Republicans say they'll do if they take control of the House. That's our controversy of the week. We'll get there in a moment, but we will, as usual, start with the main stories and how they were covered. Z Titans is Mao-like control of China. What happened? Chinese President Xi Jinping secured an unprecedented third term as head of the ruling Communist Party this week, cementing his status as the most dominant figure in Chinese politics since Mao Zedong. Xi's ascension to a third five-year term upended a two-term limit that was written into the party constitution in 1982 to prevent a return to the one-man rule of the Mao era. Xi had that limit removed in 2018. He further tightened his grip on the world's most populous nation by overhauling the seven-member Politburo Standing Committee, forcing out market-friendly moderates and promoting allies and protégés, though conspicuously none young and experienced enough to be marked as a potential successor. In a speech to the National Congress, Xi, 69, touted China's growing international influence, saying its power to shape the world has significantly increased. Without naming the U.S., he warned of dangerous storms ahead and worst-case scenarios, and drew applause for saying China will never promise to renounce the use of force to achieve reunification with Taiwan. News of Xi's leadership realignment sent international markets into turmoil, with Chinese stocks tumbling to their lowest level since the 2008 financial crisis, and the yuan's value hitting a 14-year low. The sell-off reflected worries over Xi's tightened control and the expected continuation of the economically punishing zero-COVID strategy and expanded government control over the private sector. All the rules have been broken, said Kai Zai, a former professor at the Central Party School in Beijing. Now China's future is entirely driven by Xi's will. What the editorial said. Xi's coronation portends a hard era for China and the world, said the Washington Post. He has quashed dissent, subjected citizens to systematic surveillance, subjugated Tibet and Hong Kong, and waged a genocidal campaign against Muslim Uyghurs. He's doubled down on Beijing's belligerent claim to Taiwan, cozied up to Russian autocrat Vladimir Putin, and stonewalled global inquiries into the coronavirus's origins. Under his dictatorial control, China's lodestars will remain national aggrandizement and dictatorship, not global cooperation and human rights. Xi's stronghold on power all but guarantees an era of confrontation between China and the U.S., said the Wall Street Journal. While pursuing an increasingly bellicose foreign policy, he's building a military that can project power globally and hold the U.S. homeland vulnerable. China's military might and Xi's conviction that China is destined to supplant the U.S. as the world's dominant power present the most daunting challenge the U.S. has faced since World War II. What the columnist said, Xi's total remake of the party's power structure astonished veteran China watchers, said Chris Buckley, Keith Bradshaw, and Chang Chi in the New York Times. His purging of rivals and elevation of loyalists underscores his ambition of accelerating China's rise as a military and technological superpower while maintaining unyielding party control. For China, investing so much power in Xi is a profound gamble. The history books are full of autocrats who've been blinded by hubris and overreach after surrounding themselves with yes-men. We've already seen how Xi's top-down decision-making has weakened China's economy, said Francis Fukuyama in The Atlantic. His state investment in real estate has led to massive housing complexes that have been dynamited after sitting empty for lack of buyers. And his relentless zero-COVID lockdowns have become a prolonged debacle. Xi also quashed the tech entrepreneurialism that flourished under his predecessor, said Greg Ip in the Wall Street Journal. To keep the economy under his control, he's pursued a campaign of kneecapping successful firms and targeting their leaders with harassment and prosecution. The most damaging fallout may come in foreign policy, said Hal Brands in Bloomberg. China's shift toward a more confrontational posture is bound to accelerate. And if Xi decides to use force against Taiwan, don't expect his advisors to convince him otherwise. China is now utterly controlled by a single, globally ambitious strongman who's dismantling curbs on his power as he doubles down on an aggressive nationalism. It's a familiar tale, and one that is unlikely to end well for China or the rest of us. And a second main story. In crisis, the UK selects yet another prime minister. What happened? Prime Minister Rishi Sunak took office this week in a Britain reeling from financial crisis and political turmoil. The 42-year-old former chancellor of the Exchequer, whose parents are of Indian descent, is the country's first non-white leader and its third leader in 2 months. After Boris Johnson resigned under a pile of scandals, Sunak lost the leadership race to Liz Truss in a vote put to the Conservative Party's 172,000 dues-paying party members. But then Truss, too, quit in just 45 days after her program of unfunded tax cuts tanked the British pound, jacked up the country's budget deficit, and required the Bank of England to intervene to prevent complete financial meltdown. Those horrors were exactly what Sunak had predicted when he debated Truss. So while Johnson initially tried to mount a comeback, phoning up lawmakers and trying to rally their support, Conservative members of Parliament instead chose to avert another intra-party election by uniting quickly around Sunak. Promising a government of integrity, professionalism, and accountability, Sunak, a former banker, said he would confer with his cabinet for 2 weeks before releasing an economic plan. His challenges include double-digit inflation, an energy crisis, and no mandate. The Conservative government he heads was elected in 2019 and now has just a 6% approval rating. While an election isn't due until January 2025, most Brits want Sunak to call one now. The Tories cannot respond to their latest shambles, said opposition Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, by shuffling the people at the top without the consent of the British people. What the columnist said. Poor Sunak, said Alex Morales in Bloomberg. He warned conservatives last summer that Truss would trash the economy, but they picked her anyway. Now he is on the hook for cleaning up her mess. As Chancellor of the Exchequer under Johnson, Sunak developed a reputation as a capable media performer with a slick social media operation. He'll need it to sell the tax hikes and benefits cuts he's likely to impose. Such an austerity approach won't help a country in dire need of compassionate leadership, said Kimi Chadha in the New York Times. As chancellor during the pandemic, Sunak did come up with a plan to pay furloughed employees 80% of their wages, but he yanked it away too quickly. The richest man in Parliament, he has boasted he would govern as a Thatcherite, which means slashing social spending. But with Britons facing the biggest drop in disposable income since records began, that's a recipe for unrest. America can learn from the Conservatives' parodic model of misrule, said Gerald Baker in the Wall Street Journal. The party delivered Brexit by appealing to the populist demand for more national self-determination. But as Truss found out, populist voters aren't fiscal conservatives. They want a strong welfare state, and they hate tax cuts for the rich. The Conservative Party's attempt to reconcile its nationalist and free market wings has produced abject chaos. U.S. Republicans, who are also trying to win power through populist votes, should take heed. Controversy of the week, as we saw on our cover drawing. The midterms, what will Republicans do if they win? In the closing days of this midterm election campaign, the mood among Democrats is apocalyptic, said Bess Levine in Vanity Fair. A voter backlash against the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision seems to be fading, and the latest polls have led 538.com to estimate that Republicans have an 81% chance of regaining control of the House of Representatives and a 45% chance of winning the Senate. A GOP-held House would mean total obstruction of Joe Biden's agenda, of course, and round-the-clock hearings about Hunter Biden, the president's wayward son. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is in line to become Speaker, is already planning a host of other Benghazi-like committee investigations. They will include probes into how the Biden administration ended the Afghanistan war, its border policy, and the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. MAGA stars like Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz have vowed to impeach Biden himself. Leading the charge will be Freedom Caucus co-founder Representative Jim Jordan, said Jourdain Carney in Politico. Armed with the powerful mallet of the Judiciary Committee gavel, Jordan has said he plans to use hearings to, in his words, frame up the 2024 race for Donald Trump's re-election. For maximum leverage, the GOP plans to revive its hostage-taking strategy, said Eric Levitz in New York Magazine. Despite the risk of triggering a global financial crisis, Republicans are already refusing to raise the national debt ceiling in 2023 unless Democrats accept big cuts in Medicare, Social Security, and welfare programs. The GOP says raising the age of eligibility will help shore up Medicare and Social Security, and also wants to means test benefits to reduce payments to wealthier retirees. Military aid to Ukraine is another target, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. With the U.S. and NATO help, Ukraine is now turning the tide against Vladimir Putin's genocidal war of conquest. But the two most influential right-wing voices in the country, Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump, are hostile to Ukraine and sympathetic to Russia. So the spineless McCarthy last week said the House GOP will refuse to write Ukraine a blank check. Ukrainians needn't panic, said Nick Contagio in The Dispatch. Senator Mitch McConnell is an old-school cold warrior, and he isn't beholden to Trump for his power the way McCarthy is. Even if he stays minority leader, McConnell can block extreme MAGA bills from the House. McConnell's overriding goal is to woo moderate swing voters back into the GOP, and he doesn't want to remind suburbanites that a MAGA-fied Republican Party will never govern responsibly. Republicans have a golden opportunity to shed that reputation, said Alexander Salter in Washington Examiner. With crime, inflation, and uncontrolled immigration hurting ordinary Americans, voters now want competent conservative leadership to right the ship of state. If instead Republicans squander their power pursuing the fever dreams of an egomaniac and his clownish coterie, their majority status may be short-lived. That choice has already been made, said Andrew Sullivan in andrew.sullivan.substack.com. Trumpist populism now dominates the GOP, which no longer has a coherent philosophy of government. Instead, it is a party defined by a collection of grievances. Competent, prudent leadership is too much to expect from a party whose base and leader in exile are motivated by revenge and resentment. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for galloping after designer Marcus Floyd introduced sneakers for horses called horse kicks that retail for $1,200 per shoe. It was a dope process trying to figure out what a horse sneaker would look like, Floyd said. It was a good week for Larry the Cat, a 15-year-old tabby rescue and permanent resident of 10 Downing Street in London, who, with the resignation of Liz Truss, has now outlasted four British prime ministers. It was a good week for labor saving, with news that researchers at UC Berkeley are making progress on robots that can fold laundry. A $60,000 industrial robot was able to fold one item of human clothing in 2 minutes, which the team considers an impressive speed, given the high-dimensional configuration space of garments. But it was a bad week for too much of a bad thing, with reports of moviegoers fainting, vomiting, and needing medical attention during screenings of Terrifier 2, the latest gore-filled creation of horror writer-director Damien Leone. Walkouts are sort of a badge of honor, Leone said, but I don't want people fainting, getting hurt. It was a bad week for Philadelphia police, who, in anticipation of the Phillies winning baseball's National League pennant, had applied grease to many city light poles. As per Philadelphia sports fan tradition, drunken fans climbed the poles anyway after rain washed off the grease. And it was a bad week for apiculture, after Rory Woods, 55, of Massachusetts, was charged with unleashing a swarm of bees on police officers serving an eviction notice. Informed that several officers were allergic to bee stings, Woods allegedly responded, "Good." She has pleaded not guilty. The briefing is titled, Rebuilding After Climate Disasters. The instinct to restore homes and businesses in vulnerable areas is being questioned as climate change intensifies. Why is rebuilding an issue? As wildfires, powerful hurricanes, and flooding grow more frequent and severe, it makes less sense to spend billions to restore what was lost. Hurricane Ian inflicted at least $60 billion in damage on Florida's Gulf Coast last month, leveling several coastal communities and barrier islands. The storm left both homeowners and policymakers wondering at what point the risks of oceanfront property outweigh the benefits. It's a question now facing residents throughout the eastern seaboard as sea levels rise and storm surges become more commonplace. In California, taxpayers have spent billions rebuilding woodsy communities left in ashes by wildfires, but another 6,800 wildfires ravaged the state this year. Given a choice between moving or staying and adapting to a changing climate, Most people prefer to adapt, said Nadia Cederman, a researcher at Columbia University's Climate School. But a growing number recognize that moving might be something that they may need to consider in the long term. Why do people keep rebuilding? Sentimentality combined with either extreme denial or extreme acceptance. In 2021, two-thirds of Americans polled said they would rather rebuild than relocate if their home were damaged. On the island of Nantucket, Massachusetts, where climate change is eroding the shoreline, homeowners are raising the foundations of their multi-million-dollar houses and moving them back a few dozen yards from the beach in hopes of escaping the rising sea. Most municipalities encourage rebuilding, at least partly because a decrease in the number of houses and businesses shrinks the tax base. Charleston, South Carolina is constructing a $1.1 billion seawall to protect against frequent hurricanes. But development in flood-prone areas continues, and the port city's population grew 25% from 2010 to 2020. Charleston just approved a development that would put 18,000 housing units in a floodplain near the coast. This disconnect points to a sense of fatalism. If storms, fires, droughts, flooding, and heat waves are making many parts of the country increasingly unlivable, why not enjoy a gorgeous setting while you can? We all kind of pick our own poison, don't we? Said Jonathan Kusel of the Sierra Institute for Community and Environment in fire-prone Northern California. Who's footing the bill? The government, mostly. Under the 1988 Stafford Act, the federal government provides aid with few restrictions once the president declares a federal disaster. This provides a strong incentive to rebuild devastated areas, even if it's likely they'll be devastated again. The government also spends billions every year on resilience projects to protect existing infrastructure, such as beach nourishment projects, which have been found to increase oceanfront development. Last year's Infrastructure Act allocated about $47 billion over several years for resilience projects. And communities that receive aid aren't required to strengthen their disaster planning or alter floodplain development. This creates a moral hazard. Why not take the risk of living on the coast when the government is picking up the tab? What about homeowners' insurance? Most homeowners' policies don't cover damage from flooding. FEMA offers a national flood insurance program, but after several massive hurricane payouts, premiums have risen to about $1,000 a year and can be higher depending on a home's flood history. Only one in five homeowners in Hurricane Ian's evacuation area had national flood insurance. Federal emergency aid provided through the Stafford Act can help individual homeowners rebuild, but it often could take years for the money to trickle down through the bureaucracy. So many residents rely on savings, charity, or loans. It can be very costly to rebuild because they usually have to adhere to new building codes designed to make structures better able to withstand extreme weather. After Hurricane Charley hit Florida in 2004, rebuilt homes had to comply with some of the strictest building codes in the country. Those homes fared much better in Hurricane Ian than older houses constructed under laxer codes. This is one of the many reasons why natural disasters fuel inequality. What are other reasons? Wealthier people are more likely to be able to afford national flood insurance and are more likely to navigate bureaucracies to qualify for federal disaster aid. In addition, home values generally rebound more quickly in wealthier neighborhoods. In Fort Myers Beach, one of the areas hardest hit by Ian, Trixie's Park's 1976 wood frame cottage was completely wrecked. And since she has no flood insurance, Parks, 59, plans to sell her property and move away. Five blocks away, Fernando Gonzalez's $2 million home barely suffered any damage. When he had it built in 2016, He went beyond building code requirements, raising the first floor 16 feet off the ground and digging a deep foundation with thick concrete walls that are vented to allow water to flow through them in a storm surge. If you want the luxury of living near the ocean, Gonzalez said, you have to pay. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. First up, Florida's shameful voter trap. No wonder the arresting police officers sounded almost apologetic, said Van Jones and Janos Martin. Body cam video recently obtained by a public records request shows Florida police raiding the homes of 20 ex-felons to arrest them for voting in 2020. They had voted after state residents approved a referendum restoring most former felons' voting rights. Unknown to these citizens, at least 13 of whom are black, they did not meet all the requirements for having their voting rights restored. This detail also eluded state officials who approved and in some cases solicited their applications to rejoin the voting rolls. The video showed frightened people looking bewildered as armed cops showed up at their door and handcuffed them. Why would you let me vote if I wasn't able to vote? Asked one of the detained men, Tony Patterson. An embarrassed cop replies, I've never seen these charges before in my entire life. Right, because these arrests were an act of pure political theater by Governor Ron DeSantis. Last week, a state judge dismissed charges against one of the 20 defendants, and more dismissals are likely coming. DeSantis' attempt to humiliate and intimidate black voters has a goal, but it's not to strengthen our democracy. Celebrating the 8 billionth human being. Any day now, someone will give birth to the 8 billionth human being on planet Earth, said Jeff Jacoby. This milestone should be celebrated not just by this baby's parents, but by our entire species. But to many modern educated elites, the enlargement of the human race is cause for despair and angst, not joy. Why, they say, bring more humans into an already crowded world facing climate change, conflict, and disaster? That sentiment is hardly new. In the 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, Paul Ehrlich warned that an overcrowded Earth faced widespread starvation and social collapse within a decade. But today, mankind is flourishing as never before. Yes, poverty, suffering, and war still plague us, just as they have for millennia. But for much of humanity, food and consumer goods are abundant. Powerful advances in healthcare have extended lifespans into the 70s and 80s, and life is dramatically more comfortable than it was for our ancestors. Contrary to what the pessimists say, people are the ultimate resource, creating more wealth, more ideas, more solutions to problems, and more progress. So welcome, baby 8 billion. May you lead the world even better than you found it. This column comes from the UK. A prime minister breaking barriers. Will the third time be the charm? Asked the Times in an editorial. Conservative members of the parliament have picked Rishi Sunak to be the third prime minister inside a year after the lying, scandal-prone Boris Johnson and the market-spooking libertarian Liz Truss. At 42, Sunak is the youngest premier since William Pitt the Younger in 1783. He's also the first non-white prime minister with immigrant parents who came from India by way of East Africa. Most of all, though, he is seen as a steadying choice. The Tories won a big majority in 2019, but have since squandered the trust of voters. Sunak, with his solid economic credentials, will hope to restore that trust. But he's awfully out of touch, said Tom Pyman in the Daily Mail. The posh Sunak went from Oxford to Stanford in the U.S., where he met his wife, Akshata Murthy, daughter of one of India's biggest billionaire IT tycoons. With her at his side, he became an investment banker for Goldman Sachs, and the two now boast extraordinary wealth of some $860 million. That could be a drawback. When Sunak lost the leadership bid to Truss last summer, it was partly because his wife kept her riches sheltered from British taxes. It didn't help that he held on to a U.S. green card for years, even while he was Johnson's Chancellor of the Exchequer, and still owns a $7 million home in Santa Monica. Indians, though, aren't put off by the glitz, said the Economic Times from India. We claim him as a hero. A practicing Hindu, Sunak is a vegetarian and a teetotaler and keeps a small idol of Lord Ganesha on his desk. I am thoroughly British. This is my home and my country, he once said. But my religious and cultural heritage is Indian. My wife is Indian. As if to drive home the point, he was sworn in on Diwali, the Hindu festival of light. Yet what's really significant about Sunak's trailblazing win, said Mutas Ahmed in the Daily Telegraph, is the understated British reaction. Sunak isn't seen as a radical new creature, but rather as a safe pair of hands, someone who can be trusted not to bungle things. Unlike Barack Obama in the historic 2008 election, he gets no cheering crowds. In fact, it's more of a collective shrug. But in British culture, that means a great deal. It means you are one of us. Of course, there are already leftists trying to minimize Sunak's achievement by sneering at his privileged upbringing and his career in banking. The implication is simple. He looks brown but is not brown. He doesn't count. But as for me and thousands of other brown-skinned Britons, we're proud of him. Having made history as Britain's first non-white leader, said Sherelle Jacobs, also in the Telegraph, he must take care he does not make history for a second time as the Conservative Party's final leader. The Tories trail the Labour Party in polls by a gobsmacking 33 percentage points. Now the danger is that Sunak, who was, after all, chosen to calm the markets, might put the economy before the people, slashing benefits and dooming Tory election chances. He has a daunting job ahead. The last word, our feature article, is titled The Enchantment Machine. No app has harnessed the hypnotic power of social media and video more effectively than TikTok, said Drew Harwell in the Washington Post. Its algorithms now define how young people see the world. On the night Shelby Renee first went viral on TikTok, she felt so giddy she could barely sleep. She'd spent the evening painting her nails, refreshing her phone between each finger. 20,000 views, 40,000. And by the next morning, after her video crossed 3 million views, she decided it had changed her life. She really didn't understand why it had done so well. The 16-second clip of her playing the video game Fortnite was funny, she thought, but not, like millions of views, funny. She wasn't a celebrity. She grew up in Idaho. Her last job was at a pizza shop. But this was just how the world's most popular app worked. TikTok's algorithm had made her a star. Now 25, she spends her days making TikTok videos from her apartment in Los Angeles, negotiating advertising deals, and always chasing the next big hit. Many days she feels drained by the endless scramble for new content, by the weird mysteries of TikTok's algorithm, by the stalkers, harassers, and trolls. Yet still, in her off hours, she does what all her friends do, watches TikTok. It will suck you in for hours, she said. If you have not used TikTok, you are rapidly becoming the global exception. In 5 years, the app, once written off as a silly dance video fad, has become one of the most prominent, discussed, distrusted, technically sophisticated, and geopolitically complicated juggernauts on the internet, a phenomenon that has secured an unrivaled grasp on culture and everyday life and intensified the conflict between the world's biggest superpowers. Its dominance is hard to overstate. TikTok's website was visited last year more often than Google. No app has grown faster, past a billion users, and more than 100 million of them are in the United States, roughly a third of the country. The average American viewer watches TikTok for 80 minutes a day, more than the time spent on Facebook and Instagram combined. Two-thirds of American teens use the app, and one in six say they watch it almost constantly, a Pew Research Center survey in August found. More than just a hit, TikTok has blown up the model of what a social network can be. Silicon Valley taught the world a style of online connectivity built on hand-chosen interests and friendships. TikTok doesn't care about those. Instead, it unravels for viewers an endless line of videos selected by its algorithm, then learns a viewer's tastes with every second they watch, pause, or scroll. You don't tell TikTok what you want to see. It tells you. And the internet can't get enough. TikTok's cultural influence on a new generation of media has led to some astounding ripple effects. Viral videos of people delighting in their favorite books, many of them with the hashtag BookTok, which has 78 billion views, helped make 2021 one of the publishing industry's best sales years ever. Books from author Colleen Hoover, BookTok's biggest star, have sold more copies this year than the Bible, according to data from MPD BookScan, which tracks sales at 16,000 stores nationwide. America's biggest technology innovators are reinventing themselves in TikTok's image, not only in developing short video copycats, Meta's Reels, YouTube's Shorts, but also in swapping out networks of friends and families for feeds of strangers chasing viral glory. TikTok's model could soon shape the entire internet. But TikTok's ownership by the Beijing-based tech giant ByteDance has also made it one of the biggest pariahs in Washington. Former President Donald Trump tried to dismantle it. Top branches of the U.S. government and military have banned it from government-issued phones. And members of Congress insist it could be a Trojan horse for a secret Chinese propaganda and surveillance machine. Even as the app has transformed into a public square for news and conversation, TikTok's opaque system of promotion and suppression fuel worries that China's aggressive model of internet control could warp what appears there. Many users already are self-censoring, adopting a second language of code words, unalive, not dead, procedure, not abortion, in hopes of dodging the app's censors and preserving their chances at online fame. TikTok executives have worked to soothe doubts and make friends in a hostile Washington by hiring U.S.-based specialist, promising transparency and piping American users' data through servers in the United States. But former TikTok employees and technical experts argue that the company's fixes do nothing to address its biggest risk, that its top decision makers work in a country skilled at using the web to spread propaganda, surveil the public, gain influence, and squash dissent. Many TikTok creators, though, say speculation about the app's Chinese roots distracts from the more grounded issues they face as a result of its explosive growth. TikTok's ability to make anyone go viral overnight, they say, has meant that the anger and pressure, once endured mostly by big influencers, have become facts of life for the masses. Drew Maxey, a high school literature teacher in St. Louis, said he has gotten used to seeing glimpses of TikTok in class and hearing its sounds in the school hallways. It has become the main way most students socialize and pass the time. He's even become a TikToker, gaining more than 50,000 followers with videos that use comic books as literary tools. But he worries about how TikTok's enigmatic machinery and students' desire for viral attention have already shaped how some of them talk and behave. He started changing his wording, too. On some big book videos, he won't even say the word death, anxious it might stunt his reach. Everything they need, they got from TikTok, he said. Yet we're training a whole generation of people not to say what they actually mean. TikTok starts studying its users from the moment they first open the app. It shows them a single, full-screen, infinitely looping video, then gauges how they react. A second of viewing or hesitation indicates interest. A swipe suggests a desire for something else. With every data point, TikTok's algorithm narrows from a shapeless mass of content to a refined, irresistible feed. It is the ultimate video channel, and this is its one program. The For You algorithm, as TikTok calls it, gradually builds profiles of users' tastes, not from what they choose, but how they behave. While Facebook and other social networks rely on their users to define themselves by typing in their interest or following famous people, TikTok watches and learns, tapping into trends and desires their users might not identify. The system runs on a sophisticated machine learning engine. ByteDance researchers have championed its sublinear computational complexity. But to TikTokers, the process could not be simpler. Launch the app, see the video, passively consume. TikTok fans say they've been both surprised and unsettled by an algorithm that can read them eerily well, showing them videos they never searched for or even realized they wanted to see. One creator's parody of an algorithmic flowchart narrowed from teenage thirst traps to moms and lumberjacks before reaching videos only 10 people understand. A few places on the web can match TikTok's constant promise of surprise delight. If a viewer doesn't like what's on, there's always another video, one swipe away. From the outside, watching someone use TikTok mostly looks like mindless swiping, but the system of serendipitous reward is the app's backbone, and it turns entertainment into an endless game. Every swipe could bring something better, but viewers don't know when they'll get it, so they keep swiping in anticipation of something they might never find. It's satisfying enough to keep people interested, and so unsatisfying they don't want to stop. TikTok's mesmerizing appeal has made it effectively mandatory for modern stars like Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny, who in January got more than 90 million views on one of his first videos, in which he expressionlessly eats Fruit Loops. Industries that once wrote the playbook for appealing to mass audiences are now desperate for TikTok's viral boost. A new box office record for the July 4th weekend was set thanks largely to an absurd bit of TikTok meta-comedy, packs of suited-up gentle minions mobbing the premiere of Minions, The Rise of Gru. But many of the app's best-known names have become celebrities purely on the basis of TikTok itself. Kaby Lame, a 22-year-old former factory worker from Italy, has 150 million followers, 60 million more than Trump had on Twitter at his peak. Videos by Charlie D'Amelio, an 18-year-old dancer from Connecticut, have been liked 11 billion times. The app flourished by making the creation of eye-catching videos accessible to anyone, with giant libraries of free music clips, editing tools, camera effects, and augmented reality filters in a simple, immersive interface. TikTok's central For You feed serves up videos without context or dates, making everything feel relevant and new. And unlike YouTube and Instagram, where creators are forced to compete with established influencers' polished productions, even the simplest, silliest, or most spontaneous TikToks can become massive hits. Quick duets, stitches, and remixes where people riff off or react to someone else are widely shared and given almost instant affirmation. Many use the app's green screen feature, in which their heads float over a tweet or chart or video, to offer criticism or commentary in the style of a TV news report. Thanks to its gravitational pull on creators and audiences, the app's videos now encompass practically every topic on Earth. There is fishing, hashtag fish talk, 14 billion views, farming, hashtag farm talk, 7 billion, and role playing, hashtag medieval TikTok, 4 billion. There are TikTok cops, lumberjacks, nurses, and nuns. There is domestic bliss, hashtag clean talk, and chaos, hashtag cluttercore. There is hashtag happiness, 16 billion views, and hashtag pain, 76 billion. After cornering the market on entertainment, TikTok began offering its model of behavioral tracking and algorithmic suggestion to advertisers, promising them a way to know which ads people find most compelling without having to ask. It was an instant hit. The company's ad revenue tripled this year to $12 billion, according to eMarketer estimates, and is expected to eclipse YouTube at nearly $25 billion by 2025. In the United States, the cost to advertisers for TikTok's premium real estate, the first commercial break a viewer sees in their feed, known as Top View, has jumped to $3 million a day. Beyond traditional marketing, TikTok has rapidly industrialized the way companies pay young people to hawk their stuff. TikTok runs a giant catalog of people, the creator marketplace, that companies can use to sort creators by their interest and follower accounts. The service is invite-only, and creators have to post frequently if they want a chance to get paid. Influencers paid to promote goods in their videos now make more ad money on TikTok than on Facebook, roughly $750 million, U.S. estimates from Insider Intelligence show. TikTok also takes a cut of the virtual tips or video gifts that fans pay to creators with its central currency of TikTok coins, displayed online as neon roses and donuts. This economy now rivals that of a small nation. In the past 3 months, TikTokers spent more than $900 million inside the app, the highest quarterly spending for any app in history. For young viewers who see social media influencer as a popular career path, the allure is obvious. Teachers talk about students skipping class to record dances in the bathroom. Buddhist shrines in Nepal feature no TikTok signs. John Christopher Dombrowski, a Cornell University student whose TikToks about science facts have earned him 2.8 million followers, paid his college tuition with ad deal money from Adidas and Lancome. Social media, he told the tech news site The Information, is the new American dream. A version of this article was originally published in the Washington Post. And we're over on the Talking Points page. Start with the article titled, Anti-Semitism, A Growing Contagion. The sheer amount of gross, blatant anti-Semitism on the right, said David French in The Atlantic, has reached a level I never thought I'd see in the United States of America. Former President Trump recently chastised American Jews for not appreciating how much he did for Israel and warned them to get their act together before it is too late. Trump's friend Kanye Ye West tweeted that he planned to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people and was then welcomed as a conservative folk hero on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show, where he unleashed another anti-Semitic rant that Carlson discreetly edited out. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, continues to associate with right-wing provocateur Nick Fuentes, who recently said Jews should leave America, adding, "I piss on your Talmud." An advisor to Pennsylvania GOP gubernatorial candidate and Christian nationalist Doug Mastriano called his Democratic opponent Josh Shapiro at best a secular Jew, adding that Mastriano, in contrast, supports wholesome family values. "The response from my fellow conservatives," asked Charles Sykes in The Bulwark, "at worst, crickets, and at best, a tired shrug." This sort of tacit acceptance normalizes anti-Semitism. In defense of bigots among their ranks, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, conservatives like to bring up Representative Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota. A couple of years ago, Omar accused Israel's American supporters of having allegiance to a foreign country. Democrats quickly passed a House resolution denouncing her pernicious statement, and Omar said, "I unequivocally apologize." Meanwhile, Green, who has trafficked in conspiracies about Zionist supremacists and space lasers controlled by the Rothschild family, is actually gaining power and influence in the GOP. The rise of Republican anti-Semitism is connected to its embrace of the Great Replacement Theory, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. Great replacement rhetoric contends that wealthy Jews such as George Soros are sponsoring illegal immigration to replace non-native-born white Christians. Fear of replacement has inspired at least three U.S. massacres, the 2018 killing of 11 worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the murder of 23 Walmart shoppers in El Paso in 2019, and the supermarket slaughter this year of 10 people in Buffalo. In the past, GOP leaders would denounce poisonous fear-mongering. That era is gone. And we'll take in some of the short notes. Undocumented migrant workers are in high demand in Florida to rebuild after Hurricane Ian, just weeks after Governor Ron DeSantis made headlines by flying Venezuelan migrants to Martha's Vineyard. "We'd like them back," said one real estate agent. Undocumented immigrants account for 23% of U.S. construction laborers and 38% of drywallers, according to a 2021 nonprofit report. The Pentagon will pay the travel costs of service members who choose to go to states where they can legally receive abortions. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said significant numbers of service members are based in states that limit or restrict abortion access, impeding our ability to recruit, retain, and maintain the readiness of a highly qualified force. Low water levels in the Mississippi River caused by severe drought have left transport barges unable to pass, stalling delivery of crops from Midwestern farms and other goods. The Army Corps of Engineers is dredging the river to get traffic moving, as more than 2,500 stalled barges wait to pass downriver, and other boats are left stranded in the mud. During the midterm elections, five states will hold votes on closing the loophole in the 13th Amendment that allows convicts to be used as unpaid slave labor. Those states are Alabama, Louisiana, Oregon, Tennessee, and Vermont. On the poll watch, 47% of voters want Democrats in charge of Congress, while 46% prefer Republican control. 70% of voters rate their interest in the election as a 9 or 10 on a 10-point scale, the highest level of enthusiasm for a midterm ever measured. 78% of Republicans expressed high interest, compared with 69% of Democrats. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote from comedian George Carlin, quoted in the Guam Daily Press, who says, "I was thinking about how people seemed to read the Bible a whole lot more as they got older. Then it dawned on me. They're cramming for their final exam." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.